Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome. This program was prepared before the tragedy at Meron, so I want to dedicate this program to the 45 of our brothers who died while celebrating the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and the break in the pest which killed our sage Rabbi Akiva and many of his students. The sun is shining on Israel both literally and metaphorically. The long-awaited life after COVID is beginning, and with it the spirit of our people is lifting. God willing, and with the cooperation of the population, we shall soon be back to a semblance of normality, when the traffic jams of today will get even longer by the processions of tourist buses crisscrossing our cities. I avoided saying full normality because of the economic consequences that the pandemic has visited on our traders. The main streets still show large numbers of for rent signs. Each one tells the story of a once flourishing business that could not sustain to pay during the lockdowns, the inflated rentals that are the norm, unfortunately, in Israel. Personally, I cannot understand the rationale of the landlords who would today be better off had they allowed their storekeeper tenants to remain rent-free until now, when trading is beginning and they would again receive rent. As it is, their premises are likely to remain empty even longer until there is a discernible change in the microeconomy causing them far greater loss of income. Ah well, everyone to their own. Today is May 4th, 2021, which in the Hebrew calendar equates to the 22nd of Iyar, 5781. And until yesterday, we counted 37 days of the Omer. This period symbolizes the resilience of the Jewish people, something urgently needed in these days of sadness and also political uncertainty here in Israel. It's already 5 weeks after our fifth general election and still we have no new government. There's more. Keep it here.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
It's already 5 weeks after our fifth general election, and still we have no new government. Netanyahu, desperate to keep face with the restless population, is now hawking a year's premiership to anyone who will take the bait, as if he were selling unrealistically cheap insurance. It's inconceivable that he will want to revert to be an ordinary member of Knesset only to return to the premiership for the following 2 years. Whether Gantz, Bennett, Saar or anyone else, their policy as prime minister would be different from that of Netanyahu. Would he scheme to undermine them? This kind of musical chairs will not contribute to achieving lasting stability. But more about politics a little later. In today's program, I shall be discussing a book that should be required reading at least for all high school students. I Was a Doctor in Auschwitz by Gisela Pearl describes the ethical and moral dilemmas of using her medical skills among her fellow inmates in the Auschwitz-Hungarian women's camp. There will also be some comments on the Biden administration's border policy. But I begin with this. The current period of the month-long Muslim festival of Ramadan has sparked a wave of violent attacks by Arabs in Jerusalem and various other locations. Molotov cocktails, bottles, and other objects are hurled against the Jewish populations in areas where they normally mix, and even against the police, who are trying to keep the inflamed areas contained. But there are also attacks with knives and clubs against individual Jews, often easily identifiable Orthodox youth, who happen to be in the crosshairs of some wannabe shaheed, some martyr for Allah. Security camera videos show that the victim has no effective defense but often tries to run away. If that saves lives, it's the only way he can act. One can, however, get some training in martial arts that would not only surprise the attacker but disarm and even immobilize him. When you hear about martial arts, you will no doubt be thinking of karate, a striking art using punching, kicking, knee and elbow strikes, lock holds and other methods of restraint, or judo, a modern Japanese martial art which has since evolved into an Olympic event, or even jiu-jitsu, an ancient combat sport based on grappling, ground fighting and submission holds. Any of those might help in defending oneself, but they require an inordinate amount of training. But have you heard of Krav Maga? I must admit that, other than the name, I knew very little about this effective Israeli method of self-defense until I met the internationally acclaimed founder and head instructor of Israeli Krav International and 7th Dan Black Belt, Moshe Katz. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Moshe Katz as my guest in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
I assume that Krav Maga is a Hebrew word. What does it mean?
Very true. Two Hebrew words. The second word means contact, like Devek Maga is glue, meaning we're dealing with something close up. And Krav loosely translates as combat, so it would be close quarter combat. But if you know the roots of Hebrew, Krav just means karov, close. So it really means close contact.
How does this method differ from the other martial arts that I just mentioned?
It's a very interesting point. To study martial arts, you need to understand the culture that produces the martial art. If you look at Japanese and Chinese and Thai society, you'll see what distinguishes those arts one from another. For example, Thai boxing and Japanese karate and Chinese kung fu, you'll see that their culture very, very much influences their style of fighting. Similarly, in Israel, we are an impatient people. We are a practical people. So if you told an Israeli to spend 10 years studying Tai Chi to achieve a form of self-defense, that won't go over very well. Israelis want immediate practical results. So Krav Maga is very Israeli in its culture in that it's designed to be learned quickly, effectively, no nonsense, no spirituality.
Is it simpler to learn than karate and judo and all the other arts?
Absolutely. It's designed to be learned quickly. It's designed to be using only gross body movements, not finesse. The idea is that everybody should be able to learn it. It's not something that should take many, many years of training, but to be learned quickly and effectively. So it's designed on natural body movements that we all have.
I said it was an Israeli craft. So how, by whom, and when was it invented, for want of a better word?
This is a very controversial topic. Without going into too much detail, my school of thought differs from a lot of the commercial schools. They point to a godlike figure, Emil Lichtenfeld, who came from Slovakia, and he allegedly founded the system. But history proves otherwise, that there's no single founder, and there's no only one contributor. When the Aliyah began in the 1880s, and Jews began to come back to the land of Israel in greater numbers, they were met with hostile violence from the Arabs. And the first time a Jew lifted up his hand to defend himself, you can say that moment, whenever that was the beginning of Krav Maga. And as the years went on and Jews came from many other countries, one brought a little bit of boxing, one a little bit of jujitsu. Each person added whatever experience they had, some from the military, some from sports, and they helped to develop what eventually emerged as Krav Maga. But there's no one single moment or one single founder.
Is Krav Maga only effective against a single attacker, or can one learn to defend against two or more?
It's effective against two or more as well, but it takes more of a strategy. It's not so much a matter of technique, a matter of situational awareness and placing yourself in the right way and watching all the people at different times. Nothing's going to be like a movie where one person spins around and kills 20 people at once. That's all fantasy. But two, maybe three, yes. More than that, it's very difficult, so many people at once.
You founded Israel Krav International, known as IKI for short, and I know that you issue official certificates. Is yours the umbrella organization for all Krav Maga teaching in the world?
No. There are many competing organizations, just as there are with all martial arts. We are one of many. We're not the biggest. I think we're one of the best. We operate now in 40 countries. What makes our organization different from other organizations with similar agendas, we all mean well, is that I found the other systems to be too similar to other martial arts and too difficult to learn. Meaning I look at the ordinary person of any age, of any ability, and say, can they do the technique effectively? The techniques that I see in other styles of Krav Maga, I find too difficult for the average person to use in a moment of truth.
I notice that the web lists several centers in Israel, and so they are not connected with each other.
No, each organization is separate, and each organization has its own leaders and its own program. The differences between them are like the differences between, I guess, one Hasidic group and another Hasidic group. Each one has their own slightly different philosophy and slightly different approach. What makes us different, like I said, is that I found from studying some of these other methods, they were simply too complicated to use in a real-life situation.
So if I want to take a course, how do I know which place to choose?
Again, you ask very good questions. The only thing I would say is a person should try them out. And you are the best judge of your own body. It's like we learn in the Mishnah that on Yom Kippur, if you're in an ill situation, you are the best doctor to say, do you really need to eat the food or not? You are better than any doctor. So when you go to a martial arts class or a Krav Maga class, and you try two lessons, three lessons, four lessons, and you still can't do the technique, maybe something's wrong with the teacher. Maybe something's wrong with the technique. The technique has to work for the person. With us, a person walks away after one lesson, they already feel they can do certain things to defend themselves.
You travel a lot all over the world, from Argentina to Australia, to teach Krav Maga to martial arts instructors. But how did you begin?
There were two influences that worked around the same time. One is I was very close to the late Rabbi Meir Kahana, the founder of the Jewish Defense League, and he said every Jew must learn to defend himself. And then I was reluctant. I was in yeshiva. I didn't really want to train. And then a movie came out called The Karate Kid, and my sister-in-law watched this movie, and she said, you must watch this movie. And I was reluctant because I considered watching movies to be a waste of time when one could be studying Torah. But these two influences, plus a friend of mine that tried to drag me to class, I finally agreed to give it a try. And I went to one karate class, and I liked it. Over the years, I found that karate wasn't quite as effective as I had hoped for street self-defense, so I evolved into Krav Maga.
Krav Maga practitioners are graded according to colors. You are a black belt, also a seventh Dan. Can you explain those distinctions and who awarded you that grade?
Again, excellent questions. I trained with one of the top instructors in Israel, Mr. Itai Gil, who trained the Israeli Special Forces, the Israeli Secret Police, and so forth for many years. I trained with him daily practically for 18 years. When we went on our own directions, he went to a private company. By that point, I had achieved with him the rank of fourth degree black belt, and I was the only person in the world to have received this rank from him of this high. And the rest of the ranks came from international associations that awarded me these ranks based on the recommendations of my students and things that they've seen me accomplish around the world. So up until fourth degree black belt, I received from my own teacher. Fifth, sixth, and seventh came as a recognition from international associations.
You just mentioned that your mentor, your teacher, trained special forces. I know that you have done some of that. Tell me about it.
Yes, I was greatly honored. The American government flew me in on a couple of occasions to train their Green Berets and some of their special forces in locations that we're not allowed to talk about. I've been called in to train American infantry units as well, and I've trained security guards all over the world.
There's more after the break.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Welcome back to my conversation with Krav Maga Master Moshe Katz.
I've trained security guards all over the world, so that has certainly been a wonderful honor and a wonderful privilege.
To reach the level that you have achieved surely takes a great deal of practice. You just said you trained for 18 years. Should one start early in life, and if so, at what age is it safe?
Again, an excellent question. I taught children for nearly 20 years, and what I found was with each age, there's a certain level of appropriateness. You don't want to scare a child with a gun, with a knife at age 5 or 6. I taught for many years in the Israeli school system. So when we would deal with the younger ages, it would be 5% physical, but 95% awareness, not to follow a stranger and so forth. As they got older, it became more physical and less psychological. The physical part took a greater element. I personally found the age of 7 was effective, but again, making it more of a game and sticking with simple movements that they could learn. Teaching a child complex movements will just be counterproductive. Each age has its appropriate techniques.
You advocate that that should be part of the curriculum in schools?
Absolutely. Children are subject to violence in our society, unfortunately. Especially during this recent period with Corona, there's been a spike in domestic violence. All of us have a right to protect ourselves against the violence. And the criminals don't distinguish. They don't say, this person's not in my weight category, or this person's too young or too old. That's why I advocate a very simple system that we could use regardless of our physical condition or our age. Everyone needs to learn to defend themselves, and that's a key point of my philosophy.
Have you ever had to use your skill in earnest?
I personally have never been in a fully violent situation as an adult. As a younger person, I did, and thank God I did fine. But what I do have is I have students all over the world who use these techniques on a daily basis. Just last night, I received a video from one of our students in Australia, a man named Patrick Honan, who works in security, protecting nightclubs and pubs and establishments like this. And a man came in with a knife, and he and his team subdued him using our techniques. So while I personally am not on the front lines, I live in a quiet community, thank God, but I have students from South Africa to Australia and everywhere in between who are using these techniques on a daily basis.
When you get such videos, it must be very satisfying for you.
It's very satisfying. It's always mixed feelings. I'm sad that they were attacked, but thank God they were able to defend themselves. So it is very gratifying.
Can women who are usually biologically the weaker sex effectively use Krav Maga against a strong male attacker?
I would say absolutely. And we've had many cases where women have defended themselves. I'll categorize that by saying we're not looking for a victory. Like we're not looking for an Olympic match where the woman will emerge victorious. I'm saying block, escape, get away. Not necessarily beat the man up. You defend yourself and you get away. I have a slogan I call it APC, Ability, Purpose, Circumstance. You decide how to counter a situation based on your own personal ability, personal purpose, and circumstances. For example, so if a woman is alone in a parking lot, she's just a tourist. She has no particular purpose being there. The circumstances are that she's alone. If their ability is not so great, block, defend yourself, run away. On the other hand, if you're a security guard and you're in a synagogue, he's young, he's strong, he's trained. An attacker comes in with a knife. His ability is high. His purpose is to protect the people there. The circumstances are such that if he doesn't protect these people, they may be slaughtered. So he, on the other hand, will not just block and run away. We teach that he should stay there and fight to the finish. That's why he's there.
You are tall and look strong. Does the ability to effectively use this method of self-defense depend on physique?
Again, an excellent question. I have a slogan that I use called the three unreliable friends. Physical strength, your speed, and your precision. Now, most martial arts are based exactly on that. And I say these are unreliable. If we rely upon those, we will not be successful because there's always going to be somebody stronger. There's always going to be somebody faster. And under moments of stress, it'll be very difficult to use precision to grab a person when they're moving around. So I don't rely upon these things. While it's great to have them, the stronger you are, the better, the more talented you are, the better, that's wonderful. But we don't rely upon that. We rely upon sound techniques and the natural body movements. It's interesting you say about me, as compared to most Krav Maga instructors, I don't look very tough. And people often say he looks more like a rabbi than he looks like a Krav Maga instructor. But I say the wisdom of the Jewish people is our strength.
I should add that Mr. Katz is an observant Jew with a beard.
So I often tell people when they say, you don't look like a Krav Maga instructor. I said, yes, and I can defend myself. And you don't look like a Krav Maga instructor either. And you can also defend yourself. If you had to look like Charles Atlas or the Hulk or a bodybuilder, then only very few of us would be successful.
I am biologically an old man and no longer as strong as once upon a time. Could I still learn it to be of some practical use to me?
I certainly believe so. And I'll give you a little story that inspired me from many years ago. It was in the 1960s. A young man in Ukraine saw a war veteran from World War II strolling in the park. And he had his medals on. And this young boy was 8.5 years old, and he was playing. And he saw two young men come up saying, "Hey, old man, give us some money for beer. Hey, old man, we want some money for vodka." And the old man just ignored them, and he kept walking. And they stood in front of him and blocked his path. And the young boy said, "I wish I could help this man, but I'm only 8 years old. And suddenly the old man's one hand went to one man's throat and squeezed it. And the other man, he went lower down in between his legs and grabbed him there. He squeezed both young men very strongly, pushed them out of the way, and walked between them, shaking his head. And that inspired this young man to eventually become a great martial arts instructor, because we believe that at every age, we have the ability to defend ourselves.
Well, with those encouraging words, we've come to the end of our time. But finally, if any of my listeners want to get in touch with you, how can they do it?
Well, that would be wonderful. We have a website. It's called yourkravmagaexpert.com, a bit of a convoluted name. Or if you Google Israeli Krav International, you can find us. My goal is to help as many people as I can be able to live a life of dignity and defend themselves, because we all have a right to self-defense.
Moshe Katz, Krav Maga Master and Seventh Dan, thank you for your time and your inspiring words. And hopefully you will have encouraged many listeners to take up this useful craft.
Thank you. It's always an honor and a pleasure to see you, sir.
And now we are switching into literary mode to live up to the description that the Walter Bingham file has a touch of class. It is 76 years since the end of World War II and the liberation of the Nazi labor and extermination camps. I was already an adult in 1945, an experienced frontline soldier with many bloody battles under my belt, when I learned about the harrowing details of the death camps while everything was still fresh in the minds of those who survived and related their experiences. So I thought that I really knew all there was to know about the life in those factories of death. But I was wrong, very wrong. It was not until I read I Was a Doctor at Auschwitz, a distressing account by the late Gisela Perl, a book she wrote soon after her liberation from Bergen-Belsen, having been in Auschwitz before then, and published 3 years later, that I really learned of the unimaginable details of life, or rather existence, in Auschwitz and Perl's subsequent journey to Bergen-Belsen near Hanover in Germany. It is her account of hunger and despair alternating with hope and, most of all, dedication. She tells the story of keeping human dignity during her subhuman experience and how she instilled that in her fellow inmates in the Hungarian women's camp at Auschwitz. She relates graphically how those who on arrival were sent to the right to become a camp inmate for a while. The first destination was a barracks marked beauty parlor. "We entered," she writes, "as human beings with our own identity." Then she describes how moving from room to room they were deprived of their individuality. In the first, they had to undress totally with their clothes in a heap beside them, while young SS-men's ape-like movements betrayed an unhealthy, abnormal sexual excitement. Any protests were soon stilled with blows and kicks. They were perverted, depraved thugs representing Germany's pride, wrote Perl. "When we entered the second room, we had nothing left of our former identity except our naked bodies. They had to sit on dirty stools waiting for the next indignity to be inflicted on them. The floor," she writes, "was covered with clouds of shiny, silky hair, but our heads had acquired a nightmarish appearance. When we looked up, we hardly knew each other any longer. There lay the crown of our female beauty to be shipped to Germany and used in the important war industries. After being sprayed with a burning liquid supposedly against lice, they had a brief short cold shower, and then camp life began." Perl, who tried to practice a resemblance of morality and ethics, had difficulty to accept that stealing from each other was a way of life, that for possession of an aluminium mug, one is in danger of being murdered, because it enabled one to get and store more water than can be held by forming the hands into a cup. The latrines were the one place of contact with prisoners from other blocks. They consisted of wooden planks across trenches in an atmosphere of stench, filth, and excrement.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
The latrines were the one place of contact with prisoners from other blocks. They consisted of wooden planks across trenches in an atmosphere of stench, filth, and excrement. Yet they were the marketplace where barter took place, where one could linger a while, and where friendships were forged. It was also the location of rumors about the next selection and news about the latest arrivals. The information came from prisoners who worked at the storehouses near the crematoria, selecting the belongings of those who never made it into the barracks. Many of those locations had the opportunity to steal and hide small items, sometimes food, that they found among the possessions of those whose powerful forefinger of Dr. Mengele sent them to the left at the selection on arrival. One inmate working on the refuse heap near the crematorium, where new arrivals, who never saw the camp beyond the mock showers, deposited their possessions. There he found a pouch of a kind that usually held tobacco and showed it to a camp foreman. He shook the contents into the palm of his hand, and the diamonds sparkled in the sunlight. The foreman nodded and held out three uncooked potatoes. The man grabbed them eagerly, took a bite, and started chewing as if every taste gave him a new lease of life. Here in this stock exchange of hell, as Pearl describes it, the value of a bag of diamonds was three uncooked potatoes. Although salpeter, potassium nitrate, was added to the soup to suppress the sexual impulses, girls offered love for bread or other items, and prostitution was rife. That resulted in pregnancies, which, when discovered, meant transport to the crematorium. This is where Dr. Gisela Pearl's knowledge as gynecologist helped to save the lives of the mothers, even if it meant killing the fetus, or even worse, the living newborn. The moral and ethical implications of her action tormented Pearl to the end of her life. Her expertise was well known by the Auschwitz camp administration, so that one day the feared head of the women's SS guards, the infamous Irma Gräse, who usually strode around the camp with her bejeweled whip, ordered me to report to her at the so-called maternity ward of our hospital. "I watched you operate," she said, "and I have perfect confidence in you as a doctor. I want you to examine me. I think I'm pregnant." Although touching a guard was punishable by death, so was refusing an order. Pearl describes how Gräse lay down on the bench and she proceeded with the examination. She was indeed pregnant. "Be here tomorrow afternoon. You're going to perform an abortion on me." "But I have absolutely no instruments, and it would mean death for me," Pearl politely remonstrated. "No arguments. Leave everything to me," said Gräse. The next afternoon at the appointed hour, Pearl was ready and waiting for her. When she arrived, she brought a case of instruments and her gun. "They are sterilized," she said. Then she lay down on the bench and put the gun under her head. We were both equally guilty in the eyes of her superiors. I finished the operation. Irma Gräse got up from the bench, arranged her clothes, and picked up her gun. I looked into her smiling eyes. "You're a good doctor," she said. "What a pity you have to die. Germany needs good doctors." I waited for the bullet, but she did not shoot. And I don't have to tell you to keep quiet about this. If you ever open your mouth, I'll find you wherever you are and kill you. With this, she walked out of the shack and left me with my newly won life. The coat she promised to bring never materialized. There were many other occasions at Auschwitz that can be described as the height of irony, because they contradicted the Nazi race philosophy. Blood for the treatment of German wounded soldiers was in short supply, so blood was taken from the Jewish prisoners to be given to the Aryan war-wounded Nazis, who are now walking proudly in their uniforms, not knowing that Jewish blood flows in their veins. Gisela Pearl continued to work as a doctor among the inmates. She made great friends with the other women who worked with her as nurses in the so-called hospital. At the whim of Dr. Mengele, who regularly visited the hospital, they were torn apart, never to be seen again. The special pets of Mengele were midgets and twins.
They were given preferential accommodation and extra rations to keep them fit for the cruel experiments that awaited them in the name of medical science. All this is but a snapshot of the harrowing experiences and the dilemmas powerfully written and recorded while her memories were still fresh. The book begins with a beautifully written and highly literary introduction by Professor Phyllis Lassner and Danny M. Cohen. It is my pleasure to have Professor Lassner on the line from her home in Illinois to comment further on the value of this graphic testimony among the other records of the Holocaust. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. And thank you to my invisible audience for listening in.
Now, thankfully, much has already been recorded and preserved about the horrific, almost indescribable events of the Holocaust. Yet from time to time, new evidence and graphic details come to light, like the reprint of I Was a Doctor at Auschwitz that has for years been lost to a whole generation. So how do you rate or evaluate what Gisela Perl has been telling us?
Well, she is one among many women memoirists and writers who offer testimony. And while I would not want to create a hierarchy of who's the best writer kind of thing, her writing is extraordinary for several reasons. First of all, as women scholars of the Holocaust discovered decades ago, and by the way, in Israel, you have several of those wonderful women scholars of the Holocaust who made the argument that while the Nazis intended to exterminate all Jews, regardless of gender, women had different experiences, were treated differently, they reacted differently, and wrote about it differently. So, for example, one of the major contributions that Gisela Perl's memoir makes to our understanding or our knowledge of the Holocaust, I don't like to use the word understanding because I don't think we can, but to our Holocaust knowledge is the way women experienced and responded to Auschwitz incarceration. So that, for example, if I may quote the sentence, but I think it's so vivid, the way she uses language to illustrate women's responses. This is in her chapter, Arrival at Auschwitz, with all the chaos and the yelling by the SS officers and the way in which women had no way of understanding what was happening to them. And so she writes, "When we came out of the building, we did not know each other anymore. Instead of the exhausted, tortured, but still self-respecting women who entered through its door, we were a heart-rending lot of crying clowns, a ghastly carnival procession marching toward the last festival, death." What's extraordinary about that is the prolonged metaphor of the last festival, a carnival procession towards death. One doesn't read about arrival in quite that vivid language that not only is so imaginative, but allows the reader to imagine something so extraordinary, so beyond what's conceivable. Because as we try to imagine the women being yelled at as they come off the cattle car, and then being herded left and right and being butted with rifles, you can describe that in very plain, ordinary language. But what she does, and which is, I think, a sign of how extraordinary her writing is she creates this extended metaphor. that takes us outside anything that we can conceive of as ordinary into a different realm. And she does this throughout the memoir, so that she's constantly keeping us shifting emotional, cognitive gears to try to picture something that is unimaginable.
Would you agree with my description of what you just talked about, that she actually paints pictures in print?
Absolutely. Yes, that's exactly what she does. Mm-hmm. Because we have ordinary associations with circus spectacles. And yet what we would have to do with her picture is to put the faces of terrified women on those of the performers. And this is just an extraordinary kind of writing. So that's one reason why her memoir is exceptional. Another is, and this goes along with other women's memoirs. By the way, she was not the only doctor in Auschwitz. There is another memoir by another woman doctor, Olga Lengiel, who wrote a memoir titled Five Chimneys, in which much the same happens. So you sort of have corroborating testimony. But what Gisela Pearl does is to emphasize everything as a woman's experience, not generic, not general, nothing that can be generalized. She writes about how out of desperation, isolation, and loneliness, small groups of women formed little circles in which they would reminisce about life before imprisonment, imagine life afterwards, if there is an afterward. And these social groups in which the women bonded emotionally also gave them an outlet so that imaginatively and emotionally, they could for a moment escape the starvation, the torture, the beatings, the roll calls that kept them up 12 or more hours at a time.
Would you recommend that this book should be required reading in education systems?
Well, yes, I'd love to do that. Of course, we're also talking about what level. In the United States, five states mandate Holocaust education. Uh-huh. Everywhere else, it's either just not taught at all or just barely mentioned, and maybe a young person's fiction will be offered. Or, of course, The Diary of Anne Frank is a classic, and that's, of course, appropriate for almost any age group. Yeah. But for something as searing and that describes the violent and so many extreme circumstances and responses, I would have to say that the appropriate readership for this, and I am thinking about how mature, worldly, knowledgeable young people are today, I would say high school on upwards.
In my piece, I wrote that today's youth is no longer brought up with a stalk.
Right, exactly. In fact, today's youth is performing, is behaving as though they know there's no stalk. So I think that this memoir, for example, should be taught alongside that of another mature adult male. So, for example, I would not teach this alongside Elie Wiesel's Night because he was 15. I would definitely recommend Gisela Pearl's memoir to be taught to students in high school and above, but I would also teach it alongside a memoir of an adult male to be able to demonstrate the differences, the way in which the Holocaust was a gendered experience. Mm-hmm. So that, for example, I would teach Gisela Pearl's memoir alongside Primo Levi's Survival in Auschwitz. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was also an adult. he had been a professional, a chemist, and also his memoir is beautifully written. There are many things about them that make them an appropriate pair, but they also demonstrate the stark differences between men's and women's experiences and responses.
According to Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance and Education Institute, there's a right way and a wrong way to teach the Holocaust. So although, as I say, youth today are no longer brought up with a stalk, would you agree with me that some of the graphic descriptions contained in the book could have counterproductive effects on young minds?
I would counter with a question. What are those counter effects?
Well, the moral and ethical dilemmas that are apparent in her writing.
Well, let me put it this way. The only thing wrong about teaching this kind of memoir would be to draw the wrong lesson from it, that survival was possible as opposed to being highly exceptional, that perhaps women had an easier time, which is not true. In other words, any distortion of the historical fact that contextualize this individual memoir would be wrong. But as far as moral or ethical dilemmas that the memoir represents, those are very important to teach. What would be a wrong moral? That to somehow assimilate this experience of Auschwitz into other genocides or other mass atrocities that would diffuse the exceptionality of this experience. In other words, I'm not saying that the Holocaust was unique. There are other genocides, but there are elements of it that are unique. The fact, for example, that unlike other genocides, which are geographically contained, Hitler, after all, intended to exterminate the Jews globally. So that, for example, had he invaded England, had he invaded America, had his invasion of North Africa been successful, all of the Jews in all of those places would have been exterminated. That's an exceptional feature. Another way that one has to remember in teaching, and this I think would be wrong, would be to say that women's experiences should not be emphasized or highlighted because Hitler wanted to exterminate all Jews, regardless of gender. It's very important that women's experiences be attended to. So, for example, Gisela Perl has a chapter called A Piece of String and another one, The Latrine, in which in A Piece of String, she describes a situation where a Polish worker tried to extort sex from her because she so desperately needed a piece of string to keep her shoe on. Of course, in distributing the so-called clothing, the Nazis were very clever. And in order to dehumanize the prisoners further, they gave them ill-fitting clothes that made them either hobble when they walked or actually produced terrible sores, which could lead to gangrene. And this Polish worker offered her a piece of string to keep her shoe on and potentially alive in exchange for sex. She almost gave in, and then at very last second, she ran away. Now that was an emotional and a moral choice that she made. On the other hand, in another chapter called The Latrine, she describes how people found the latrine a place of privacy where they could have sex. Now, this may turn the stomachs of many readers, and you're talking about young readers, and we could say, oh, we don't want them to know about this, but it was an ordinary piece of life in Auschwitz. People did have sex, and they found the private place in a latrine. I mean, it's mind-boggling, but it's so much a part of the experience in Auschwitz. It cannot be omitted. It cannot be redacted. That would falsify what the experience in Auschwitz was like.
What I found also extraordinary was the value of food compared to a pouch full of diamonds. I don't think I would have survived a day there.
None of us can know. I mean, we certainly wouldn't want to be tested. There are many different approaches to what survival means in a place like Auschwitz. Most people, and that is survivors, as well as scholars, historians, everybody pretty much agrees it was a matter of luck because you have no control over your body in these circumstances. Whether you're suffering from dysentery or you're shot because you're menstruating and the blood is running down your leg, and the Nazi who's in charge decides that this is an abomination and shoots you. So it's a matter of luck if you survived. So I don't think, in my own view, we could say, oh, I would do everything I could. Sure, so did they. But at the end of the day, nobody had control over their bodies or over their fates.
Back to the book and your final thoughts.
This memoir, which is so extraordinary, was out of print for many, many, many decades. It was originally, Gazela Pearl wrote it after the war, obviously. It was originally published in 1948 in a kind of yucky edition. And that was the one that I found originally, serendipitously, in a used bookstore.
And you have it?
Yes.
Wonderful.
And it wasn't until Danny Cohn and I taught a chapter and talked about it that we began to think publication is possible. And once again, as luck would have it, a very good friend and brilliant scholar, Victoria Ahrens, edits a Holocaust and Jewish Studies series at a publishing house, Lexington Books. And we approached her and she said, sure, you know, submit a proposal, submit an edition of the book. So we did. And they are the ones who are responsible. But a couple other things I want to mention. Yeah. The drawing on the cover, which is, we think, just a perfect fit, is by a Holocaust survivor artist by the name of Eva Kadishon Schieber, who now lives in Ramat Aviv. She was a survivor as a hidden child on a small town in Serbia. I want to bring attention to that. I also want to bring attention to the really courageous, heroic work of the women scholars who made the argument that women's experiences needed to be attended to as women's experiences. And I'd like to add, as an epilogue, we're so happy because the book is selling like hotcakes.
Really? It was wonderful hearing your assessment of the book. And thank you very much, Professor Phyllis Lassner, for your valuable time.
Thank you very much for inviting me, for bringing attention to this marvelous memoir, and thank you very much.
I Was a Doctor at Auschwitz by Gisela Pearl is available from all good book outlets. Now, a few more thoughts about world politics. Denmark is reviewing the residency permits of their Syrian asylum seekers with a view of returning them to their country of origin. Other European countries are contemplating similar action. They found that their humanitarian action in accepting large numbers of so-called Muslim asylum seekers from the Middle East and beyond had disappointing effects. Unlike the post-war Jewish refugees, they did not respect the culture of their host country, but attempted to, sometimes forcefully, impose their lifestyle on the indigenous population. In many cities, ghettos developed, which in some cases became no-go areas even for the police. Unfortunately, the Biden administration in the US have not learned from the experience of the Europeans and have reversed the border policy installed by President Trump. While you are listening to this program, large numbers of illegal infiltrators, among them undesirables like members of drug cartels and other criminal elements, are crossing the U.S. territory via the southern border with Mexico, encouraged by the rhetoric of Biden. The border guards are overwhelmed and are not receiving the support they need. The intention of the current U.S. administration is to integrate them as citizens. Their appreciation would then swell the Democrat vote and establish a permanent left-wing government. Whilst the dominant religion of the Central American states is Roman Catholic and South America is mainly Christian, the mentality of the illegal population is different from Muslim, and the problems that arise from the influx are economic and criminal. To integrate such numbers will have a long-term detrimental effect on the U.S. Because those immigrants will not insist on the minimum wage, unemployment of the unskilled and semi-skilled American workforce will rise. And that is just one of Biden's miscalculations. Now, news has broken that John Kerry, former U.S. Secretary of State under Obama, has leaked Israeli military information to Iran. According to Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, Kerry has informed him that Israel has attacked Iranian interests in Syria at least 200 times. Further developments are expected. Kerry is climate czar in the Biden administration, and calls are already being voiced for his resignation. Finally, did you know that April the 30th is conspicuous for the birth of royalty? Mary II, Queen of England with William III, was born on this day in 1662. Queen Juliana of the Netherlands saw the light of day in 1909. And King Gustav of Sweden was born in 1946, all on April the 30th. But this date produced also some other famous and even infamous men. Among them, in 1870, one of my favorite composers, Franz Lehár, and the Nazi foreign minister Joachim von Ribbentrop, Yamachimo, whom I interviewed following his capture. He was born in 1893 and lived until he was the first to mount the gallows after the Nuremberg war crimes trials, at 1:30 a.m. on the 16th of October 1946. He denied to me any knowledge of the Holocaust. And with those facts, I end for today. Thank you for listening, and I hope to be back again next week, same time, same place, with another program about Israel and the rest of the Jewish world. Until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a pleasant week. In many countries, COVID is still causing sickness and death, especially among the elderly. So wherever you are, please make it your business to make sure that your elderly neighbor is comfortable. Goodbye.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.home page, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio. Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.